From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, former Texas Congressman Tom DeLay, no longer a convicted criminal, but that's not the end of the story. The American Bar Association takes Texas to task for the way death penalty trials are run in the state. And it's being called a scandal. Texas is supposed to be protecting an endangered West Texas lizard, but satellite photos tell a different story. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Tom DeLay was known as the Hammer when he was the congressman from Sugar Land and the House Majority Leader. He played a tough brand of partisan politics in Washington, D.C., and talked openly about his plan for a permanent Republican majority. But in 2005, he was indicted on felony money laundering charges, which he eventually was convicted of. But on Thursday, on appeal, that conviction was overturned, and he was acquitted of all charges. Craig Holloman is the government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizen in Washington, D.C.
I was very surprised. A lot of people have worked long and hard to convince the original jury that this was indeed money laundering, and the evidence is quite overwhelming. So I was quite surprised that the three-judge appellate courts would actually reverse the ruling. And not only that, they actually declared a full acquittal for Tom DeLay, dismissing all charges and all allegations. So this is a big step backwards. However, I do know the state of Texas is appealing the case to the full court, so this is far from over.
Facts of the case, still, they're not in dispute at all. Tom DeLay received $190,000 from corporate donations. He sent that money up to Washington, D.C., to a Republican entity. They gave him a check in return for $190,000. He took that money back to Texas, and he gave it to politicians running for House seats in Texas.
That's correct. The facts of the case are not in dispute. What is in dispute is how one interprets money laundering. It is the original jury determined that money laundering had in fact happened because Tom DeLay had raised $190,000 in corporate money. Texas may not have a very strong campaign finance law, but it does take seriously the prohibition against corporate contributions to candidates. And so DeLay laundered the corporate money out to the Republican National Party, which then sent back the same amount of funds raised from individuals to be given to seven different candidates in Texas. The original jury ruled this is just flat-out money laundering, and I strongly agree. I mean, this is just taking illegal money and cleansing it for the purpose of making campaign contributions.
So dirty money goes in, clean money comes out. That's money laundering.
That is money laundering. However, the appellate court, the three-judge appellate court, decided no, that in fact, I mean, in an outrageous decision, they really stretched the dimensions of the law here. They argue that Tom DeLay, in fact, tried to comply with the Texas Election Code, and therefore they determined there was no criminal activity. Now, I mean, that's just an amazing stretch of the law. I mean,
how much does partisan politics play a role in this? Because these judges are elected.
Yes, partisan politics appears to play a great deal in this. The case itself was long delayed. You know, this violation of Texas Election Code happened all the way back in 2002. And in 2010 was when the jury finally convicted Tom DeLay and sentenced him to 3 years. And then it took all that time till now for the appellate court to come out to reverse the decision. And part of the reason why it took so long is because Tom DeLay's legal team then challenged one of the judges who was going to be sitting on this court because that judge was a Democrat. And we're able to get that judge removed from the court, and have three different judges, handle this case. And with a 2-1 decision, this new court sided with Tom DeLay. It would appear his legal maneuvering paid off well. However, this is short term. The state of Texas is appealing this to the full court, and so we're going to get the entire court weighing in as to whether or not this is money laundering.
Well, how much different will the full court be?
I think it's going to make a difference. First of all, you're going to get the judge who was removed weighing in on this case. Secondly, you're going to get quite a bit of public attention to the case with the full court handling it. It really stretches the imagination to try arguing that laundering of dirty money into clean money is not actually money laundering. And that's what the court would have to actually rule to hold up this reversal. I am expecting the full court to be a little fairer and a little more balanced.
Craig Hallman is the government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizen in Washington, D.C. He's reacting to the overturning of the money laundering conviction of former Congressman Tom DeLay. Texas continues to carry out capital punishment more than any other state. Texas has executed 12 men so far this year. 6 more people are scheduled for the remainder of the year. The most recent execution was Thursday, as Robert Gene Garza was put to death for his part in a gang ambush where 4 women were gunned down in the Rio Grande Valley. Garza maintained his innocence until the end. He said his confession to police was made under duress and was improperly obtained. The way Texas conducts capital murder trials is taking some harsh criticism from the American Bar Association. They say Texas has made a lot of improvements over the years, but there's still a long way to go to meet the standards of many other states who also still continue to have the death penalty. Jennifer Lauren is a professor at the University of Texas School of Law and helped write the ABA report.
The report really finds that aside from sort of isolated deficiencies in practices, Texas's system of administering the death penalty is one that really lacks checks and balances from beginning to end, such that individual errors or individual bad practices are, in fact, insulated from discovery, and in some cases are exacerbated by other practices at different stages in the process. So what you have is sort of not just examples of isolated practices that are deficient from a national standpoint and just kind of an objective best practices standpoint, but also that sort of structurally reinforce each other to really undermine an overall sense of confidence that the system really has the checks and balances that it should have to ensure that we're accurately identifying people who are guilty of capital crimes and that we're accurately identifying people who do in fact merit imposition of the ultimate punishment.
What about the use of DNA evidence to clear people who've been convicted of crimes, and the access that the convicts have to use DNA evidence?
The issue of preservation of evidence and access to that evidence in order to bring claims of actual innocence was a concern of the report. Texas has enacted some meaningful provisions for preservation of DNA evidence in capital cases, evidence that actually pertains to a case in which a capital charge is brought, and that's very important. And we credit Texas for making that effort in its law. One important way in which Texas's evidence preservation laws are lacking, however, is that Texas only requires preservation of physical evidence that might contain DNA in cases in which capital charges were sought. Now, that excludes, for example, violent felony cases, which often conviction of which can often be a basis for the state to argue for the appropriateness of the death penalty in a given case. So, for example, a defendant may be on trial in a capital case, right, and at the sentencing stage, the state's argument would be that the death penalty is appropriate in part because this individual actually has a past conviction for a violent felony. It's very important in those cases for individuals to actually have access to evidence to, for example, potentially argue their innocence.
So with DNA evidence, we know now for sure that people will confess to crimes they did not commit because they make a confession, they go to trial, they get convicted, and then the DNA evidence comes up and it says it's not the guy. So some people are saying what we ought to have in Texas is that we need to videotape or audiotape the entire interrogation process so that we will be able to find out if someone has been badgered or emotionally twisted in a way that they would confess to something that they didn't actually do. Is that a reform that y'all are interested in?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the ABA benchmarks is a benchmark that calls for the recording of all custodial interrogations. That's really viewed as a best practice nationally. Texas does not do it at the state level. There are probably within Texas individual law enforcement agencies that do that. The team was not able to determine that there was in any sense sort of widespread or even actually by our data isolated compliance with that benchmark. But this is the example of a reform, one that has really widespread support among law enforcement nationally. Law enforcement offices that have moved to record confessions have found, one, that it's technologically feasible, particularly today. We can all do this on an iPhone, frankly. But two, that ultimately it really is in law enforcement interest to have a record of what goes on in custodial interrogations. It's best for the courts because they can sort out disputes about what occurs in the course of an interrogation. And on balance, it's good for law enforcement because not only does it create an objective record, but it lets law enforcement, show the jury that they're engaging in best practices when they are. Texas has not required this. The team absolutely recommends that the legislature enact a requirement for recording of custodial interrogation. But one thing it's important to emphasize about this recommendation is that this is something that can happen without legislative action. In other words, this is a kind of reform, frankly, like better open file practices in Texas that can really bubble up from below. And law enforcement organizations, which I really do hope will review this report, can take it upon themselves to develop internal policies to start recording custodial interrogations.
Do you think that the adoption of these reforms that you all have suggested, that it would increase the public trust in executions? When the state executes somebody, they do it in the name of everyone in the state of Texas. There are people who support the death penalty, but they want to be assured that everything is being done to make sure that we are executing the guy who did the crime.
I think that's a hugely important part of the team's work. I think some of the areas of concern that were most striking to the team and where there are just the clearest paths for reform and where Texas is the clearest sort of outlier in terms of what goes on nationally are places where you see really a kind of black hole in terms of understanding what the relevant actors in the criminal justice system are actually doing or whether they fully understand the work that they're doing. A great example here is the work of juries in capital cases. Quite properly, we place an unbelievable amount of trust in the role of the jury to really weigh the evidence in a capital case and make a considered both legal and moral determination about whether someone deserves the ultimate punishment.
Jennifer Lauren is a professor at the University of Texas School of Law. She helped write a report for the American Bar Association critical of Texas and the way capital punishment trials are conducted. The dune sagebrush lizard is the most controversial reptile in Texas. In the 2012 Republican Party of Texas platform, the West Texas varmint was called out, quote, "We strongly oppose the listing of the dune sagebrush lizard, either as a threatened or endangered species." The lizard was on the verge of getting federal protection, but then there was a landmark agreement to protect the lizard in West Texas between the state comptroller's office and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But a watchdog group says that agreement is being violated by the state, and there's an active cover-up to keep information from the public about what's really going on with the dune sagebrush lizard. Timothy Mail is the Vice President of Conservation Policy and Science at the Defenders of Wildlife.
A sand dune lizard, a small species of lizard that is found only in a small portion of New Mexico and Texas, and a species that was proposed for listing, indicated by the federal government that it deserved to be listed, but was put on a candidate list because there wasn't enough money or time for them to get to a listing. They recommended it be listed as endangered when they reached that conclusion. But in June 2012, reversed themselves and said, we're not going to list this species. And the story I hope we get to talk about is, you know, that decision and what we believe are some really significant flaws in what's happening in Texas with regard to the conservation of the species.
The word scandal has been used in describing what happened from the Texas Comptroller's Office. What happened? What is the scandal?
Well, I guess the scandal as we see it is that, first, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the federal government, approved an agreement in which they are precluded from seeing what participants who are signing up under the agreement with the comptroller are actually doing on their property. Second is that between that date I indicated, between June and 2012 and June of this year, we've looked at satellite images that show in the habitat where the lizard is found, where in theory, in the documents that clearly state there should be no disturbance, there is disturbance. There are new gas wells or oil wells, new roads, new transmission lines, new well pads, all going on. And in the reports that are submitted on a monthly basis, which we requested, that from the Comptroller's Office to the Fish and Wildlife Service that describe how much habitat disturbance is going on in these areas, the reports for the period we looked at were 0 acres, 0 acres, 0 acres. And this is within the space, one of the spaces in Texas where, you know, it's one of the principal locations for gas and oil production in the United States.
Yeah, it's right over the Permian Basin.
You got it, right. And it's a little surprising when earlier claims were that, you know, the listing of the lizard was going to prevent America from getting energy to have reports that, in fact, no energy development is occurring there. So we looked at that. It's black and white, or actually in color. You can look at the satellite photos from that year, and you can see new construction going on in places that other documents say, that other documents commit to there being no disturbance on a lizard. And there are many flaws, we believe many flaws, in the way that this particular agreement was set up, and that should not by any means have resulted in the lizard not being listed. But the really glaring thing is that habitat destruction is going on, and it's not being reported.
Who files these reports that say that no energy activity is happening where the lizard's supposed to be?
Yeah, so the Texas Comptroller's Office is in control over all of the agreement. They have contracted out most of their you know, role in this to a foundation called the Texas Habitat Conservation Foundation. That foundation was created solely for the purpose of carrying out this agreement and is controlled by lobbyists for the Texas oil and gas industry.
Is it a voluntary compliance?
It is a binding agreement. Once you sign up for it, the one example we have is a ConocoPhillips. That's the only one that's been made public voluntarily. All the other agreements we've been refused access to, even though we've filed, you know, through FOIA a request for information. Through that agreement, they commit. It's a contract, right? It's a legally binding contract that says we will do the following things. We will avoid disturbing habitat in these places. We will pay to offset for habitat impacts in these other places. That's what we're concerned about, is the impact of the species that's happening under this agreement, unreported. And there's, as I indicated, there's a lot of the information is being kept secret, not only from us, but from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And we're really concerned what the rest of that information would show if anyone were to have access to it.
To falsify these reports, is that a criminal act?
I do not know. There are other people from government agencies who could indicate that. But certainly to us, The satellite imagery that clearly shows disturbance looks like a violation of the agreements.
Timothy Mail is the Vice President of Conservation Policy and Science at Defenders of Wildlife. He says the State Comptroller's Office is violating an agreement to protect the threatened dune sagebrush lizard, and there's an active cover-up to prevent the release of information about oil drilling activity in the lizard's habitat. This week, the Lower Colorado River Authority voted to seek an emergency stop to releasing water downstream that would reach the Matagorda Bay on the Texas coast. The LCRA officials say the reservoir lake levels are dropping too low due to the drought. Environmentalists say the fresh water release is needed for the health of the bay. Myron Hess is the manager of the Texas Water Programs for the National Wildlife Federation.
The LCRA board voted to seek emergency authorization to cut off the environmental flows for Matagorda Bay. And the environmental flows for Matagorda Bay are intended at this point to maintain a sanctuary area in the bay during drought conditions to help the organisms there make it through the drought.
So we're talking about the water flow. Is the water's where right now?
So this is this would be water that would flow into the Lake Travis and Buchanan, which are above Austin. And what this authorization would do is allow them to cut off those flows that they would otherwise have to pass through the lakes and down the river to Matagorda Bay.
So these are two man-made lakes, the Highland Lake area that we, and so this water is created for what? These reservoirs, what was the purpose of that?
So the reservoirs were created for a combination of flood control and water supply purposes. And LCRA manages those lakes under what's called a water management plan that sets out various conditions for how you balance different uses of water from the reservoirs. And one of the conditions in the water management plan is that they will pass water through the reservoirs to maintain adequate conditions in the river downstream and in Matagorda Bay.
So they want to hang on to the water, or they see the water going out to Matagorda Bay as an unnecessary use of the water, that they should hang on to that water for drinking water for Austin and
for other water supply. Right. So we're in a serious drought. There's no question about that. And as a matter of fact, the water management plan accounts for that and actually reduces the amount of water that is required to be passed for environmental protection as lake levels drop. But LCRA has sought permission to cut off the flows in a way that's inconsistent with what the water management plan would require. And basically, I guess the concern is that, yes, that they would hold those inflows for other water supply issues. And certainly we do understand that, you know, you reach a point where you're really talking about very essential uses of water for humans, that it's appropriate to, you know, make that decision. But we feel it's premature at this point because we're still using a lot of that water to keep lawns green. And it's, in our opinion, it's not in the, so the National Wildlife Federation doesn't believe it's appropriate to completely cut off the flows to the bay, basically so that we can keep lawns green.
So if they said, we're going to cut off the flow, would the Colorado River go dry?
No. So there'll be a certain amount of flow in the river below Austin. They do maintain some releases to maintain water quality in the river, and they haven't proposed to cut those off. But a lot of that water that's released below Austin actually gets diverted by other uses farther downstream. So this is an amount of flow that would be released just to get to the bay.
So right now they're just asking for emergency permission from the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality to
temporarily stop the freshwater inflow to Matagorda Bay. It's still up to the TCEQ, and do we have any idea where they may be on that?
We don't. The LCRA will submit their application, and TCEQ will have to evaluate it. TCEQ does have specific rules that govern this sort of relief that, in my opinion, should result in this request being denied. And the reason for that is that the rules basically say that in order to get this kind of emergency relief, you have to have demonstrated that, you know, there really wasn't an alternative way to address the water supply situation. And we believe they could have done it differently by seeking authority to reduce all types of water uses and do this in a more equitable manner.
So if they follow the rules, it's pretty much a slam dunk. They're not going to do it, but there's politics.
Always difficult to predict how the various factors will be weighed by the agency in deciding, you know, what's an appropriate action. Again, we are in serious drought conditions, and I'm not questioning that. And that's clearly a factor that has to be looked at. But it really is a question of sort of deciding how we're going to balance these various competing water uses. And again, it's sort of a question for me, is it more important to keep lawns green or to provide this flow for the estuary, which is really, it's not designed to keep the estuary in overall estuary in good conditions. We're way past that. The estuary is in bad condition now. This is really just designed to maintain a sanctuary area in the estuary so that when we do get more normal rainfall, you've got healthy organisms in that sanctuary area that can kind of go out and help the bay recover.
But we're seeing here is the drought and the direct impact on the water supply in Texas. Tough choices having to be made. It's just incredible that we've gotten to this point.
They are. Definitely we're at the point of having to make tough choices. And basically, our concern is just that we need to make sure we do it in an equitable way that recognizes the importance of all the various uses of water. And if we aren't careful and we, you know, cut off flows to the bay too severely, you know, it may not recover in a timely fashion. And that's a significant impact for a lot of people. I mean, it's not just that we're concerned about organisms. It's also a lot of people who make their livelihood on Matagorda Bay from taking people fishing, tourism, from the seafood industry, all those things that also depend on a healthy bay. So it really is important as we're making these tough decisions to do a very careful balancing. Our concern is just that by cutting off the flows to the environment on this emergency basis, that that's not an equitable way to do the balancing.
Myron Hess is the manager of the Texas Water Programs for the National Wildlife Federation. He is reacting to the request of the Lower Colorado River Authority to cut off fresh water supplies to the Matagorda Bay. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also comment directly on our website. That's at tpr.org. That's also where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. And you can listen to us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.